At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Well, let's see. Where should we begin? Mergers and acquisitions? Healthcare policy? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? We've got them all, you know. I'll think about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 11th of December. Friday. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. It's been quite a week, actually, economy-wise and business-wise. More than enough, I'd say, to fill four, or I think today it's actually 4.5 minutes of live radio. So we will do the best we can as we wrap up the week that was. Sudeep Reddy is at the Wall Street Journal. He is down in Washington. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. She is in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So let's see. Lee, I guess we'll start with you. The big merger news of the day confirmed that Dow and DuPont are going to get together for $130 billion worth of deal. What does the year in M&A, because it's been quite the year, tell us about the state of the economy?
Yeah, it's been a huge year. It's been the biggest year since 2007, which is hard to believe. But I think it tells us that growth is not easy to come by. Organic growth is not easy to come by. And these companies are merging to juice growth. If you can't, you know, if sales aren't growing at X percent, you know, buy a company, cut it, you know, eliminate overhead.
11,000 jobs
costs.
Like they're going to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what's driving this. A lot of it is also, you know, there's a fear that lawmakers are going to cut back on inversions. And so get it while you can. Right. There's a lot of things driving it, but those are two big ones.
The overseas tax thing, the inversions thing. Sudeep, let me ask you this,
though.
So Dow and DuPont get together and they become a force in, let's say agricultural chemical stuff. Right. And so Monsanto now looks at that and says, oh, man, I got to go buy somebody.
Exactly. It's the mega merger trend. It happens in every industry. You get larger and larger companies, and eventually, a few years down the line, they'll break themselves up again because they realize they don't all belong in one enormous piece. And we see this over and over again, but this is what you see in the late stage, unfortunately, the late stage of an economic cycle. You see companies giving up on coming up with new ideas and finding ways to innovate and just going and doing a merger. We saw this in 2007. We saw this in 1999. We know what happened after both of those periods with this record boom in mergers and acquisitions. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it probably tells us something about where we are in the economic cycle.
That does not warm my heart. All right. Different topic, Lee. A company that is, I think it's getting smaller. You can't really tell. Yahoo announced this week that it's not going to spin off its big Alibaba thing because of tax implications. It's going to do a reverse spin and spin off the core business. Is there anything that can save the Yahoo that we all once knew?
I don't know that there is. And it's funny because a lot of people think that, you know, the tax issue is the main reason. But there could be tax issues with this way, too.
Right.
And its problems, of course, go deeper than taxes, way deeper. So it's really a striking week for Yahoo.
Do you think, Sudeep, that it eventually just becomes a shell of its former self and we say, oh, yeah, I remember Yahoo. The way we say I remember, not quite pets.com, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, of course. And two decades ago when Yahoo came up, it was an exciting company. It actually deserved the exclamation point at the end of its name. There was so much there to it that got people excited about the internet and what it offered. And now it looks like a lot of other companies. You wonder, why is this company even in Silicon Valley anymore? There isn't some great technological innovation coming out of it. It's essentially another media company. We have plenty of media companies. They put things online. They try to collect advertising for them. It's nothing special. It could still be a viable business, but it's not going to be the kind of high-tech, exciting startup people have been hoping it would find a way to reinvent itself as. And maybe it's just time to move on.
All right. Let's see. I've got a minute and a half left. What do I want to do? Well, I want to do two things, so we're going to do them quickly. First of all, Sudeep, I find it interesting that we are at the budget deadline date. Today was government shutdown day, except it's not going to be because Speaker Ryan and everybody have worked out deals. There is no panic, though, in Washington that there was no shutdown panic. Everybody was like, oh, yeah, Paul Ryan's going to fix this. Has he become sort of the savior?
He has become the savior in preventing Republican meltdowns in the House. And so at least for a brief period, he's going to have a chance to maybe let them live to fight another day. But Republicans in the House have put their hands on the hot stove so many times and gotten burned by playing with the shutdown game, playing the debt default game. Yeah. All of these games, they don't work in the end. And Paul Ryan recognizes that. The entire leadership recognizes that. And they're just not willing to play the game now when there are so many other things that they're focused on in terms of the election and where they've got plenty of things that they need to fear in terms of what the Republicans look like.
All right, Lee, last question of the day to you, and it's about Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve and the question of interest rates. The question is not, are they going to raise the rates? My question to you is, it's a question about a question. What question do you have about what's going to happen afterward? What are you most curious to see what happens?
It's very simple. It's not very interesting or exciting, but I'm very interested to see what the market's going to do because it seems suddenly that we're just expecting it. You know, after all this time, it hasn't been that big of a news event that this is really, it's cemented. This is going to happen. And I love how she's kind of been managing the language, which she's so very good at, saying, finally, this is the day we've all been looking forward to. This means so many good things for our economy. And she's right about that, but her language has changed very strongly in the past couple of weeks.
So, Sudeep, same question to you real quick.
It's all about how much does Janet Yellen indicate her concern about a world that's on fire right now. The U.S. recovery is fairly disappointing. The overseas economies are all in trouble. And that kind of messaging is going to be the most important thing. And we will see that in her press conference, how carefully she dances around some of these issues.
Sudeep Reddy at The Wall Street Journal and Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine in New York. Thank you both.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a good weekend, everybody. As for Wall Street today, yeah, let's not, okay? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so Congress is, as I said, working on a budget deal, which will get done eventually. One of the line items that might wind up in the thing is something called the Cadillac tax. It's about healthcare, part of the Affordable Care Act. It's designed to help slow down healthcare spending by taxing high-priced insurance plans. Plans that, the thinking goes, encourage people to spend more on care that they might not need. Anyway, there was talk afoot about delaying that tax beyond when it's supposed to start in 2018. So, let me recap here. Delaying something that's going to do what pretty much everybody says we ought to do, cut healthcare spending. From the health desk at WHYY, here's Dan Gorenstein.
At its most basic, the Cadillac tax penalizes health plans that exceed $10,200 for an individual or $27,500 for a family. Why penalize those plans? Boston University economist Austin Frack says, think of them like a buffet.
I'm going to eat, you know, as much as I need to, and then I'm going to eat, you know, 30% more because I'm not going to pay anything when I make another trip to get more shrimp and, you know, lo mein and whatever I like.
In other words, as far as the consumer is concerned, going to the ER is no different than seeing a primary care doc. So really, the goal of the Cadillac tax is to get people with employer-sponsored insurance to be more cost-conscious. The hope, says Bob Kocher, a former healthcare advisor to President Obama, is that this will put pressure on the entire industry.
If you want to have competition, you need to have the patients have some incentive to shop and compare.
But right now, what consumers are facing is more out-of-pocket exposure. As we approach 2018, when the tax is supposed to take effect, employers have started shifting costs to their employees to avoid the tax. Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute says as that happens, people are cutting back on all of their care.
Some of that care is going to be really problematic if they don't get, and it could wind up costing themselves and the system more money in the long run.
While tax supporters agree this approach is far from perfect, former Congressional Budget Office Director Doug Elmendorf says it's one of the few ideas we've got to control health spending.
People keep going to the buffet for health care. Then they'll end up getting certain kinds of care that don't help them be healthier.
Not only does that last plate of mac and cheese not help you, says Elmendorf, it's expensive, and we all end up paying for it. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace desk of You Had One Job, this item. UPS is apparently having trouble keeping up with the flood of online sales and thus deliveries as we head into the thick of the holidays. The company promises everything is going to be all right, but we asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison to find out what the heck is going on out there.
An analysis by the software company ShipMatrix, first reported in the Wall Street Journal, shows UPS on-time delivery performance last week falling to 91%, down from 97% during the same time last year. The consulting firm Kurt Salmon is seeing similar trouble. Steve Osborne helps retail clients with supply chain.
We have not seen error rates this high since 2013.
That may not sound too scary unless you remember that 2013 was an absolute nightmare for carriers. Waves of packages didn't arrive in time for Christmas, and people were furious. As Christmas gets closer, the stakes get a lot higher. UPS isn't publicly discussing its on-time performance numbers, but is reassuring people things will be okay. Spokesperson Steve Gott says part of the challenge is the predictions it gets from retailers.
This is a typical phenomena during peak where the volume of shipments that come to our hubs varies from the forecast that we're given by our retailers.
Retail consultant Steve Osborne says that forecasting is harder than ever.
They're looking at past trends, but they don't have great data from the people who will actually be buying.
That's you, the increasingly unpredictable shopper. Now that you can buy anything, anywhere on your phone, retailers and carriers are having a hell of a time figuring out your next move. Rob Martinez is CEO of Shipware, which helps clients manage shipping. His data show UPS performing better than other reports, but whatever's going on out there, he is crystal clear with shoppers.
My advice to consumers would be to shop early.
In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
I could guess right here about how much money is going to be raised and spent this election cycle, but honestly, I'd probably turn out to be wrong because I didn't guess high enough. Billions and billions of dollars, suffice it to say, and maybe a couple more billion after that, too. People and groups who think there is too much money in politics, though, in this post-Citizens United era, are trying to do something about that, and increasingly they're doing it at the local level. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
It's a wet, chilly December morning in the nation's capital, but the mood is upbeat in the Wilson Building, the seat of city government in Washington, where D.C. Councilmember David Grosso is about to unveil his latest campaign finance reform bill.
And I'm excited to be here this morning for this press conference.
Grosso called the press conference to introduce what he calls fair elections legislation, a bill that would establish public financing for local candidates to counteract big money in city elections.
For me, this is about lifting up the voice of the everyday voter and making sure that individuals in the District of Columbia feel that they have the same power as the big corporations have.
Earlier, Grosso told me he modeled his legislation after a public financing law in Connecticut. He noticed that Seattle voters passed a measure establishing publicly funded vouchers voters can hand out to candidates. Maine voters updated their public financing system. Grosso says there's a common theme here.
The Supreme Court has ruled. I think the Congress members aren't doing much of anything at all. And so they're really kind of stuck. So all these local jurisdictions are starting to say, hey, we can try to tackle this on our own.
Nick Penniman wants to help those local jurisdictions. He heads a campaign finance reform group called Issue One. He wants to help local lawmakers like Grasso introduce legislation on things like public financing of elections, ethics, and lobbying reform. His plan? Develop boilerplate reform legislation for local politicians.
We want to be able to give them great models that they can pull off the shelf, slap their name on, file, and begin fighting for reform at the state and local level.
There's just one problem. A few problems, actually. According to Richard Berfault, he's an expert on campaign finance law at Columbia University. He says voters can have mixed feelings about public financing of elections.
I mean, public funding has often been criticized as, you know, welfare for politicians. You know, you get politicians saying, you know, the public's money should go to schools or police. And not to campaigns. And that's a popular stance.
And then you have to get candidates to accept public money and the restrictions on private fundraising that usually come with it.
Public funding is not going to work in the sense of becoming taken on by significant candidates unless there's a significant amount of money.
Still, Perfault says it's not a bad idea to pick your battles and focus on cities and states where there's an appetite for campaign finance reform. But Nick Penniman of Issue One, his ultimate goal is national reform.
What we're trying to do is build momentum at the state level so that we can eventually surround Washington with victories and with energy that Washington won't be able to bat away anymore.
Penniman says this is like the Gilded Age, the time around the turn of the 20th century when a hyper-concentration of wealth and political corruption led to major campaign finance reform. Unfortunately, it didn't last. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was just like a family doing the recording sessions, and everybody put their heart and soul in it. Just for the joy of working with it.
The making of a holiday classic. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, you knew this was coming. The Dow Industrials off 309 points today. 1.75% closed at 17,265. The NASDAQ dropped 111 points, 2.2%. 49.33. The S&P 500 down 39 points, 1.9%. Finished at 2,012. For the week, let's just say terrible, okay? Terrible. Dow Chemical and DuPont gave back some of the gains they made earlier in the week on rumors of their merger. Today, the news came, and Dow Chemical gave back 2.8%. DuPont dropped 5.5%. Oil prices hit seven-year lows. Energy companies finished the week much as they began, losing it. Chevron dipped 3.2%. ExxonMobil off 1.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is officially the last day of the Paris climate talks, keyword there being officially, because the French foreign minister has already said that the next draft for negotiators to chew over isn't going to be out until tomorrow morning. But we do have a general enough outline of a deal to ask some what happens now questions. Marketplace's Scott Tong is at the sustainability desk in Washington. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
This meeting has been interesting for a whole lot of reasons. One of the things that kind of grabs you, though, is that it's all voluntary, right? What kind of teeth might we expect when the final, document comes out of this thing?
There are no penalties for backsliding, as you say. To the negotiators, they say, yeah, there are a lot of teeth or virtual teeth to this. I'm going to give you two climate vocabulary words to describe this.
Okay.
Each country has brought a pledge to limit emissions. And in the text, at least for now, they'll promise to come back in 5 years with even bigger pledges. And the big word here is ratchet up ambition. Oh. And if you think about it, right, a physical ratchet has actual metal teeth. You can only crank it one way.
Yep, that's right.
And the other word is transparency. Every country is going to show its work one way or the other. And if it's not seen as a team player, it gets named and shamed. But here's what the skeptics would say. You know, good luck keeping to that diet, that carbon diet. You're really not going to eat that fossil fuel donut. It's tempting. It's proven. It's cheap. It's packed with energy. It's commercialized. I mean, history suggests self-interest beats voluntary willpower. That's what a lot of the history and the economics tell us. So in the end, the real test will be emissions levels and how the market reacts to all this.
All right. So you and I spoke the other day about changing the energy diet of this planet. And part of that is new technologies, right? Part of that is wind and solar, and I don't even know what's out there. How much of this is people betting on the come, that in 5 years when they get back together, there's going to be some whiz-bang new thing, or maybe some better version of what we have now?
And we are in the middle of that when it comes to energy right now, Kai. I mean, down the road, the bet absolutely is there will be more and better tools to make clean energy, to deliver it, to store it, to scale it. I spoke to Ethan Zindler at Bloomberg New Energy Finance today, and he says, to look at the future, just look at the past.
If you look at the promises that were made coming into this negotiation, those were far more ambitious than countries were willing to make 5 years ago. And the reason why they can do that is because the costs have come down over those 5 years. It is much cheaper to promise to go to a zero carbon energy sector, for instance, now.
Now, here's the uncertainty, though, Kai.
Yeah.
We're not great at predicting technology. We've seen these trends, but let's say oil and gas stay super cheap as they are today. It gets harder for renewables to compete in that environment. And if you're an investor in, say, a big wind farm, you'll want a return of 20-25% every year. So that'll be the reality check.
All right. So slightly different topic. You remember Copenhagen six, whatever it was, years ago, right? Famously, Obama goes over there, heads get knocked together. There's, oh, my goodness, we're going to get a deal. And then fundamentally nothing happens out of the last big UN climate conference. What happens if nothing happens out of this big UN climate conference? Then what?
I keep asking that question and I keep getting it's not going to happen this year. This weekend, they do have to work out who pays. What's the goal? How are they going to show their work? When are they going to bring back the band for the next round of pledges?
Yeah.
Worst case scenario, they can still be stuck on Sunday night and come back in a year and still call it the same meeting. You know, the 21st Conference of the Parties. They could still do that. That would be under-delivering.
Right.
And the last time talks under-delivered, you mentioned Copenhagen in 2009, you could say it set things back by 6 years or so.
Right.
Because back then, the plan was to get all the big emitters on board together. And here we are back again, talking about that same thing, building a foundation and going from there.
Scott Tong at the somewhat depressing sustainability desk. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Popular culture this time of year is, if you really think about it, largely about repetition. You hear the same Christmas carols over and over and over again. Television networks roll out the same holiday specials they've been rolling out for decades now. So today, another installment of our seasonal series, The Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
This time, the making of that perennial television special, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. From Montreal, Emma Jacobs reports.
Rudolph began life as a seasonal marketing campaign. He appeared in the coloring book the Montgomery Ward Department Store gave out in 1939. Rudolph was a well-known song by the 1960s. Then there was the TV special.
Oh, is this your snowbank?
No. Who are you?
It took the story, added more music, and a cast of whimsical characters, like Rudolph's friend, Hermie the Misfit Elf.
Well, actually, I am a dentist.
A dentist?
Well, I want to be someday.
A real celebrity, Burl Ives, played Sam the Snowman. The other characters were all played by lesser-known actors and news personalities from around Toronto. Paul Soles was a host for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He's now one of the few surviving members of the cast. He played Hermie and can still demonstrate how he transformed his voice.
An elf is small, right? And this is a children's show. So you do a voice that you think is childlike and is small. And you know that children have these higher voices because their larynxes are not very big. So they can't have a deep voice.
Rudolph's producers had come to Canada for that vocal talent and low costs. They were Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass. They'd go on to create many holiday specials and TV series, including the 1980s era Thundercats. The recording sessions for Rudolph took place at RCA Studios in Toronto. Bill Giles was the sound engineer.
It was just like a family doing the recording sessions, and everybody put their heart and soul in it. The actors would work overtime, and I worked overtime and stuff like that, just for the joy of working with it.
The stop-motion animation was done at a studio in Japan. It also completed several of the commercial breaks for GE, which sponsored the whole production. Giles remembers sitting down to watch the television broadcast with his children when it aired in 1964.
I have two kids. They were 7 and 5, and they were excited. They didn't take their eyes off the TV.
And they're still watching it on television. Rick Goldschmidt is the go-to historian of Rankin Bass Productions. The company folded in 1987. About Rudolph, he says.
It became such a big success those first couple of years that the ratings just kept growing and it never stopped airing.
On its 50th anniversary last year, the show still drew an audience of 10 million people. For many of the actors and crew, it's the most famous thing they ever worked on, though they never earned any royalties beyond what they were paid for those recording sessions. Today, the show also has commercial life on stage. A musical version began touring last year that sticks closely to the TV script, and you can find Rudolph clips all over YouTube. So while the making of Rudolph may in fact be history, the story of the red-nosed reindeer is still lighting the way for holiday entrepreneurs. In Montreal, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
You're welcome for that earworm, by the way. All right, this final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that A, I'm a bit late on my Christmas shopping, but also B, I am clearly something of a cheapskate. I just saw today a November survey from Gallup that Americans are planning to spend $830 on presents this year. That's like $830 a piece, like per person, which it seems a little high, no? Lousy Friday on Wall Street today. The Dow off 309 points, 1.75%. The NASDAQ off 111 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 down 39 points, 1.9%. Next week's big news, we'll tell you that today. Yeah, Janet Yellen, Fed meeting, interest rates. There you go. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.